Yay, nay, oh man.
Welcome to another episode of Yay, Nay, or Meh, presented by the Raw Footage Podcast. I don't have quite so many films to review in this particular episode, so I don't think this episode will be as long as recent releases have been, but I still have a total of 6 films to review for you. We have the Australian queer teen romance, Ellie and Abby and Ellie's Dead Aunt, which rather surprisingly actually got a cinematic release this week. We also have the other big cinematic release of the week, the Oscar-winning film The Father, which I have already seen at an online film festival, so I'm going to release the pre-recorded review of that. On streaming platforms, we have the dystopian vignette movie Under Gods and a small-scale psychological thriller, I guess you would call it, called Zebra Girl. And on the subject of Zebra Girl, I think that is one of those films that I'm arguably going to have to mildly spoil in order to fully review it. Suffice it to say, if you want to go in relatively fresh to the film Zebra Girl, and I do actually recommend the streaming film Zebra Girl, it is not the film that the marketing makes it out to be, which is why I'm going to have to go into a little bit of spoiler territory, but I still think it's very good, if a little bit disquieting. So, approach with caution, but I do recommend Zebra Girl, and that's my non-spoiler-ish review of that film, but a full review will be coming later. And also reviewed in this episode, we have the Netflix films Secret Magic Control Agency, a CG animated film from Russia, and the Malaysian Oscar submission for this year to the International Film Competition, the disquieting horror movie Roh, also known as Soul, but you can find it on Netflix as Roh. So those are the films which will be reviewed in this particular episode, and let's start out with Ellie and Abby and Ellie's Dead Aunt. This is an Aussie queer teen comedy, written and directed by Monica Zanetti. This is her feature film debut as writer-director, although she does have a few shorts in her past, and she's also worked as a writer and producer on the TV shows of Tom Ballard, a very funny queer Aussie comic. So she does have a little bit of background behind the camera, but this is her feature film debut. And it tells the story of 17-year-old Ellie, played by Sophie Hawkshaw, who is a straight-A student. She's the school captain, and she's also gay. But she is so shy that she has not yet plucked up the courage to ask her crush out to the formal dance, the Australian equivalent of prom. As she is working up the courage to ask out the object of her affection, Abby, played by Zoe Terrakes, she starts getting visited by the ghost of her dead aunt, played by Julia Billington. She was a lesbian activist in the 1980s who died before Ellie was born. And now her ghost is coming around and offering advice on how to ask out this girl in her class. All the while, Sophie Hawkshaw's mother and the dead Julia Billington sister, Marta Dusseldorp, is not dealing with this at all well. So the support structure for young Sophie Hawkshaw is Rachel House, the awesome Kiwi actress Rachel House. It seems like all the Antipodean films I've seen recently have had Rachel House in them, which is great. I mean, she's a brilliant actress. I mean, she was in Hunt for the Wilder People. She was a voice actress in Soul, the Pixar film Soul. She's been in loads and loads of Kiwi and Australian stuff. She's awesome. But yes, Sophie Hawkshaw's quote-unquote aunt, Rachel House, is helping her out, as well as her actual dead aunt, Julia Billington. So can Sophie Hawkshaw and Zoe Terrakes figure it out and get all these odd influences out of the way in order for these two girls to attend formal together? And the adjective that most comes to mind when I think about Ellie and Abby and Ellie's dead aunt is adorable. That might sound a little bit condescending, a little bit patronising, but I don't mean it to be. I mean, this is charming, sweet, delightful. I loved the chemistry between these two 17-year-old girls. The awkwardness that both of them feel, the tentativeness of, do I dare approach this girl who I'm not 100% sure is into girls? How do we make this work? And then you have the comedy aspects of this dead relative from a different era giving advice, which is a little bit out of date and a little bit different. I mean, things have changed. And I think that's the other thing which this film does so well. As well as being a very cute, very sweet, very awkward teen romance between two girls, it's also an examination of the generational shifts in the queer community. What people in the 80s, what activists in the 1980s, like the now dead Julia Billington, had to go through, has led to a situation where things are more open. Julia Billington, this ghost, shows up and says, I'm here to help you come out. And Sophie Hawkshaw says, well, yeah, I don't actually need help coming out. It's fine. I mean, there's five other gay kids in my class. We have Facebook now. We don't need to have the awkward conversation. We can just text each other now. I mean, technology has moved on. Attitudes have moved on. So this slightly old-fashioned attitude that this ghost has, you know, the things that were acceptable and needed to happen in the 80s, are no longer relevant in 2020. So seeing how that has shifted, seeing how the groundwork that was laid by these militant activists in the 1980s, and seeing how that's progressed to now, and having these uncomfortable juxtapositions of things that you did in the 1980s not working now, and equally seeing how things are still kind of relevant, albeit in mildly different ways. I mean, there's a whole subplot about AFL, I mean, Aussie Rules Football, and that leads to one of the genuinely laugh-out-loud funny moments in the film. These lesbians connecting over watching Aussie Rules, or pretending to connect over watching Aussie Rules. And it's cute. I mean, I do think that this attitude that the modern 17-year-old Sophie Hawkshaw has, compared to her militant activist aunt from the 1980s, seeing how that whole plays out, I mean, it's worth examining and assessing where we were, where we are, and how far we've come. And yes, that is an interesting and a valid element of this film, but much, much more than that, it's just a really, really sweet, really funny, really charming, really awkward teen romance. And I really, really liked it. I mean, the chemistry between Sophie Hawkshaw and Zoe Terrakes is excellent. Brilliant supporting performances from Rachel House, who, like I said, you know, rarely puts a foot wrong. And also, Ellie's mother, Marta Dusseldorp, has a really interesting role. I mean, the trigger which allows the ghost of Ellie's dead aunt to show up is the fact that Sophie Hawkshaw finally comes out to her mother. And it's done in the most casual, the most abrupt way. She just blurts out in the kitchen to her mother, "I'm worried because I'm building up the courage to ask a girl out to formal." And her mother looks at her and says, "Yes, Mum, I'm gay." And, you know, coming out to her mother is the trigger which allows this ghost to show up. And it happens very, very quickly in the film. I mean, this is a film which doesn't waste any time getting to its point. The premise and the setup is dealt with very, very quickly, which I do kind of appreciate. I mean, it's like, here's this gay girl. She's come out to her mother. This is the girl that she fancies. This is the situation. And oh, look, here's a ghost. And that basically happens in like 5 minutes. So it's rapid fire, but it works really well. And when Marta Dusseldorp hears her 17-year-old daughter saying, "I'm gay," I mean, she does not handle it well. And initially you think, this is a story about bigotry. This is a story about the struggles of coming out, which, you know, in the Western world, we've kind of got past, I think. But as the film progresses, we realise that Marta Dusseldorp has very specific reasons for not responding well to her daughter coming out. And it very much revolves around her dead sister, Julia Billington. And her feelings about her dead sister and what happened to her is very much built into how Marta Dusseldorp reacts to her daughter coming out. This is not a case of bigotry. This is a case of concern and fear overcoming the natural love she has for her daughter. So, yeah, it's an interesting role for Marta Dusseldorp, a complex role for Marta Dusseldorp. And the relationship between mother and daughter, I think, is eventually handled really, really well. And towards the end, Marta Dusseldorp does become supportive, rather uncomfortable and awkward, but supportive of her daughter, and her daughter's approach to life, which is very modern and is very different from the 1980s. I mean, this is a girl who is actually a bit of a nerd, which is one of the reasons why she is so awkward about the girl she has a crush on. She's all about these online self-help gurus and daily affirmations and aphorisms, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the natural first thing she does after the ghost of her dead aunt has appeared to her is she looks up delusions online, which is a natural thing to do. And, you know, when her quote-unquote fairy godmother shows up, which Julia Billington really leans into the whole fairy godmother, which is actually kind of cute. But all around, this is a cute, adorable, charming film, which I really, really liked. I think it's exactly the right balance of heartwarming and thought-provoking. I mean, referring back to a specific protest in 1989, which apparently happened in Oxford Street in Sydney, which is apparently, you know, one of the major thoroughfares in the queer community in Sydney. But apparently there was a specific protest in 1989, which this film makes a lot of references to. So, you know, showing what was going on in 1989 and what's going on in 2020, and that is valuable and that is interesting, but over all of that is the fact that this is just a really delightful film. I really, really liked it. If you were listening to this quick enough, you might still be able to find it in cinemas, albeit it doesn't appear to be in very many cinemas. I mean, of the sort of 6 or 7 cinemas I can get to with relative ease, this film is only showing in one cinema. But it is currently available through Curzon Home Cinema, and no doubt it will be available wider through streaming platforms soon. And however you see it, I do urge you to see it, because for me, Ellie and Abby and Ellie's Dead Aunt is a delightful film. I really enjoyed it, and it's a thorough yay. So the other cinematic film that I want to talk about in this particular episode, I have already seen before the Oscars, at which it won 2 Oscars. But here is the review I recorded a couple of months ago for The Father.
Pre-recorded start.
So I have just watched an online festival screening of The Father, the multiple Oscar-nominated film directed by Florian Zeller and starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. It was a screening at the Borderlines Film Festival, which is based in the English Marches region from Herefordshire up to Shropshire, and is basically based around Hereford, which is only 78 miles away from Bath, unlike the 300-odd which the Glasgow Film Festival was away from me. But yes, I am grateful to the Borderlines Film Festival for allowing me to watch this film legally before the Oscar ceremony. And it looks like this recording is going to be released after the Oscar ceremony, and therefore after my Oscar preview show. So you probably already know that I think I'm going to give Anthony Hopkins my win as Best Actor at this year's Oscars. I think he's outstanding in this film, and it really surprises me to say this, because I thought Chadwick Boseman had it won hands down in my mind. I mean, I'm assuming by this point Chadwick Boseman did win the Oscar for Best Actor posthumously, but I think by a hair's breadth, Anthony Hopkins might actually deserve it more. With this film, Anthony Hopkins playing a man suffering from dementia who is refusing to accept help from his endlessly patient and endlessly loving daughter, Olivia Colman. And as the film progresses, we start to realise that things are definitely not what they seem. People change appearance, people change names, their functions change. Is this even my daughter? Is this my daughter's partner? Wasn't she going off to Paris a minute ago? Things change within the same scene. Somebody leaves the room and suddenly we're at a different time, a different place. It's a fractured, unsure narrative from an unreliable narrator. And it's been executed masterfully by writer-director Florian Zeller, based on his own play and the English translation done by Christopher Hampton, who did the English translation of the play and is the credited screenwriter of this as well. So, yeah, it's a fascinating and heartbreaking portrayal of somebody losing their mind, who is not sure of anything which is in front of him. Is his daughter going to Paris? Is his daughter married? What has happened to my younger daughter? Why hasn't she visited me? And whenever the younger daughter is brought up, the reaction of the people around him suggests that the younger daughter is never coming. But time shifts, perspectives shift, things get repeated. I mean, the same scene gets repeated several times throughout the course of the film, and it means slightly different things at slightly different times. And the context for what is happening and who is even on screen at that point shifts dramatically over the course of the film. I think it might be an interesting exercise, although perhaps a somewhat futile exercise, but I think it could be done, that you could re-edit this film, put it in chronological order, and you would have a somewhat coherent narrative as to what's actually going on. I think you could possibly do that, but that kind of defeats the point. But it does show that even when we as an audience and the people around Anthony Hopkins know what is going on, know what is happening, he doesn't. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't realise that his mind is slipping away from him, and everything he sees, everything he does, everything he knows is up for debate. And it's heartbreaking to see, and it's an outstanding performance from Anthony Hopkins. I mean, yes, as I said, I'm assuming Chadwick Boseman has already won the Oscar, and he will be deserving. I thought he was excellent in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and I did give him my personal Raw Footage Award for Best Actor of 2020. And my guess is that Anthony Hopkins is going to be a heavy, heavy contender for Best Actor in my 2021 Raw Footage Awards, because this is outstanding. The breadth, the spectrum of what Anthony Hopkins has to do in this film, silently standing in the middle of a room and through little expressions, little pieces of body language, we get to understand that this person doesn't actually know what he's doing at the moment. And it's just a simple, quiet scene of absolute silence. But the acting performance lets us know that his mind is elsewhere. He is not necessarily there anymore. At certain points, he is unbelievably charming and gregarious and outgoing. And on a dime, he instantly switches to viciously dissect everybody around him and make painful statements, probably untrue statements, about his family. And about, you know, the younger daughter who never visits him. Why hasn't my younger daughter visited him? She's my favourite daughter. And he says this right in front of Olivia Colman. And Olivia Colman just has to put up with it. I mean, yes, I think Olivia Colman is very good as this endlessly patient woman who loves her father and desperately, desperately tries to make it work so he doesn't need to go into a home. But it's clear he cannot live alone anymore. He cannot survive alone. He needs to be institutionalized. And the painful realization is one of the things which happens over the course of this film. Or does it? Because there is a reading of this film where the opening scene is where Olivia Colman has made that decision, and the rest of the film is just fantasy and flashback. So yeah, every single thing in this film is up for debate. Who are these people? What are they doing? Where are they? Is very much up for debate throughout the entire course of the film. I mean, my guess is that when this was on stage, and I'm actually passingly familiar with the play, The Father, because it premiered here in Bath at our historic Theatre Royal. And eventually went on to the West End, and Kenneth Branagh got loads of Olivier Awards and Critics' Choice Awards for Best Actor in, I think, 2015, 2016, I think it was. But it premiered here in Bath, so I saw posters for the play, The Father, for several years, because it did come back again and again to Bath. But yes, my guess is that when it's on stage, it's a very minimalist staging, where the audience has to work out for themselves where they actually are, where the character Anthony Hopkins / Kenneth Cranham is, whether he is accurate in where he thinks he is at any one point. and my guess is the audience has to work that out for themselves. But here in a feature film, we get to see where Anthony Hopkins is at any one point, and we get to realise, oh, it looks like he might actually be in two different flats at various points in the film. And then elsewhere in the film, I mean, he needs to have medical intervention. So this is a film where you can definitely see the stage roots, but unlike something like the aforementioned Ma Rainey's Black Bottom or The Boys in the Band, the feature film aspects of this film do come through, because we do have interstitials, establishing shots of other places where the characters are, and they are definitively different places where Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman and the other members of the cast are. And we get to see that they are different places, where my guess is on stage, it's the imagination of the audience which lets us see that. So yes, you can see the stage roots of this film, but it is definitively a feature film, despite the fact that 99.99% of this is people sitting in a room talking. But crucially, it's different rooms and different places, and a very large, very luxurious flat in Kensington has various different options for staging these conversations. So dynamism of the feature film does come through, and there are certain scenes where these conversations, particularly between Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman, are filmed in extreme close-up, which I think was an interesting choice and adds to the intensity of the scene. And I also find it rather interesting, rather charming, that the character that Anthony Hopkins is playing is called Anthony. And I can't help thinking that's deliberate, because apparently Florian Zeller, when he decided he wanted to make a film of his play, the first name he thought of was Anthony Hopkins. So I think in the English script, the character was named Anthony, possibly on the off chance that Anthony Hopkins would want to play it, because I have looked it up, and even in the English translation of the play, it is set in France and the character is named André. So, yeah, changing it to be set in England and also naming the character Anthony, I think was maybe stroking the ego of the Oscar-winning knighted actor. But either way, it's a fascinating play, and it's been brought to the screen in a really interesting way, in a way in which everything is up for debate. I mean, there was a French version of this play, a French adaptation on film of this play called Floride, which was the last screen performance, feature film screen performance of the late Jean Rochefort back in 2015. And I've looked at the trailer and it looks like a very, very loose adaptation of the play La Paire. But anyway, this is the second version of this play on screen technically. But this is an exceptional piece of work. And because everything is up for debate when we see it on screen, there's a genuinely shocking moment which happens towards the end of the film. I mean, one person's reaction to Anthony Hopkins. And because of the way the film has to be structured, with time shifting within the same scene, characters shifting within the same scene, we are not entirely sure whether that shocking incident actually happened, and if it did, who did it? That's very much up for debate. You can create several scenarios by the end of the film which explain that particular shocking and horrifying moment. And that's the great thing about this film, or what I perceive as the great thing about this film, is the fact that everything is up for debate, everything is fractured and unsure and possibly not even real. There's so much going on here, and it's an outstanding central performance from Anthony Hopkins, who, by the way, I have not heard sounding this Welsh for quite some time, but it's an outstanding performance from Anthony Hopkins. In my opinion, an Oscar-winning worthy performance from Anthony Hopkins. Excellent supporting work from Olivia Colman. We'll have to see whether she made my personal list as a best supporting actress nominee. In real life, she did, but we'll have to see how my Oscar preview went. But yeah, this is an outstanding film. It's kind of a hard film to watch, but the fact that so much is questionable, so much is unsure, it's a really outstanding piece of work with a fantastic central performance. So yes, it's a little bit challenging, but I think The Father is excellent. And for me, it is a definitive yay.
Pre-recorded finish.
It is really interesting listening back to that audio that I recorded a couple of weeks before the Oscars, in the aftermath of Anthony Hopkins actually winning the Oscar, because I was so convinced that Chadwick Boseman would win Best Actor, as indeed the producers of the Oscar ceremony were so convinced that Chadwick Boseman would win the Oscar. But yeah, I think Anthony Hopkins thoroughly deserved the Oscar he got. And I also think that The Father deserved the other Oscar it got that night, which was Best Adapted Screenplay for Florian Zeller and Christopher Hampton, even though I would have mildly preferred that particular Oscar went to The White Tiger. I think The Father was an excellent and a worthy winner of that category as well. And I also recorded that before my Oscar preview show, where I did give Anthony Hopkins a Best Actor nod. And I also think that Olivia Colman should have won Best Supporting Actress as well. Even though I don't begrudge Yoo Jung-yoon her win as Best Supporting Actress, she was thoroughly deserving, but I just preferred Olivia Colman. So, yeah, all around, the performances, particularly of Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman, are excellent. But I do think credit needs to be given to the other supporting actors in this film. I mean, basically the entire rest of the cast in this very contained film. But Mark Gatiss, Olivia Williams, Imogen Poots and Rufus Sewell all put in excellent performances as various aspects of Anthony Hopkins' fractured mind, who change perspectives, who change characteristics throughout the course of the film, to the extent that Olivia Williams and Mark Gatiss are just credited as the man and the woman, because there's so many different aspects which they are playing during the course of the film. But yeah, it's an excellent, excellent film. And the more I think about it, the more I think I possibly should have given The Father my personal choice as Best Picture at the Oscars this year over Judas and the Black Messiah. I think The Father has stayed with me a lot more than Judas and the Black Messiah has. So who knows, by the end of the year, The Father might be higher up in my top 10. And I fully expect The Father to be in my top 10 films of the year at the end of the year or at the beginning of next year. But yeah, it's excellent. It's outstanding. It is currently in cinemas. And if you hadn't guessed already, The Father is a definitive, unquestioned yay.
Watch at home.
The first streaming film I want to talk about is a small-scale British indie film called Under Gods, which is the feature film debut of writer-director Chino Moya, who is a Spanish director based in London who has a background in music videos and commercials. But for his debut feature film, Chino Moya has created a dystopian future world, which is very bleak, very grimy, very decaying, and set a series of interconnected stories and vignettes which show the horrors and the deprivations of this possibly post-apocalyptic landscape. It's never made clear, but it's definitely a problematic setting. which was actually filmed in Estonia and Serbia. So it's got lots of decaying, modernist, brutalist, concrete structures, which, in the wake of the Soviet era, have just been left to crumble. So if you want to film something dystopian, you go to Estonia and Serbia, I guess. But anyway, there's these series of stories with a very wide and a very eclectic list of cast, a vast ensemble cast, with some very interesting names on it. In this film, we have people like Geza Rurig, the star of the Oscar-winning film Son of Saul, who's also apparently going to be playing Jesus in Terrence Malick's new film. So, yeah, curious about that. We also have the Irish actor Ned Dennehy from Peaky Blinders and Good Omens, the Belgian actor Jan Bivoot, who was in Embrace of the Serpent and The Broken Circle Breakdown, both of which were nominated for the Foreign Language Oscar. We have the Scottish actress Kate Dickie from Game of Thrones and The Witch, and also the English actor Bern Gorman from Torchwood and Pacific Rim. So, a very bizarre, very broad collection of people in this film. And, yeah, I was intrigued by this post-apocalyptic or certainly dystopian vignette movie. But I'm not entirely sure Under God's works. Many of these stories are so brief that we really can't connect to them. I mean, once we get into them, once we get involved in them, they're over. And a lot of them run along fairly similar lines. Many of these dystopian vignettes follow the same basic pattern of person in a decaying environment allows a stranger to enter their life through politeness or societal expectations, and then that stranger who has come into their life basically destroys their life. And that pattern is repeated several times throughout the course of the film. I mean, basically all the vignettes of this film make up that same basic pattern. Stranger comes in and destroys life and is only accepted in because of politeness. And it's kind of repetitive. I mean, yes, we have connective tissue. I mean, we have a framing device, almost, kind of, but not exactly a framing device because they do get involved. But Geza Rurig and his colleague Johan Myers are basically going around picking up the dead bodies which are just lying on the streets and selling them for meat. And that's kind of the framing device of this film, and also kind of sets you up for how horrifying and broken and disgusting this world is. But it just doesn't connect very much. When all you've got is this decaying environment, this horrific environment, but you're essentially telling the same story over and over again, it gets repetitive, it gets weird, and I'm not sure it's entirely worth it. And despite having a certainly interesting and mildly impressive cast, and being in the weird situation that of the many, many entities which put money into this film, one was the government of Estonia, and another one was Ridley Scott's production company, Scott Free. And Ridley Scott's son, Jake, is listed as one of the executive producers on this film. So, yeah, there's some backing here and some intent here. And I would kind of be interested to see what Chino Moya comes up with in the future. But for this particular film, I actually think it's a nay. I just don't think it's worth it. Under Gods, in my opinion, is interesting, but not interesting enough to say it's worth watching, and certainly not worth paying for, in my opinion. So, Yeah, I was a little bit unimpressed and underwhelmed by Under Gods. And for me, it's a nay. I mean, not a particularly passionate nay. I just don't think it's worth it. So, for whatever that's worth, Under Gods is currently available through streaming. The next streaming film I want to talk about is Zebra Girl. And as I said at the opening of this podcast, I am going to explore the plotline of Zebra Girl a little bit further than what the marketing has led us to believe. This is the debut feature of the American-born, British-based director Stephanie Zari, and is based upon a play by Derek Ahernan, who also writes the screenplay for this film, alongside the director Stephanie Zari and the star of the film, Sarah Roy, was apparently also involved in the script. I saw the trailer for this come up. I saw it listed in the available streaming options, and it looked kind of interesting. The marketing and the trailer makes it look like this young wife, played by Sarah Roy, finds out a shocking secret about her husband, Tom Cullen, which unfortunately leads to murder. And then Sarah Roy calls up her childhood best friend, Jade Anuka, in order to help her clean up the mess, you know, clean up the body. And that's what the marketing and the trailer made it look like. But that is really not what this film ends up being, which in my mind is a perfect case study of the perils of marketing. You need to sell the film, even if what you are selling is not at all the film you end up providing. But you need to know what sells, you need to know what will attract people to a particular project. So, to some degree, you need to lie to them. And I think that's what the marketing for this film has done. The IMDb plot is, quote, Catherine's seemingly perfect rural life is turned upside down after she discovers her husband is hiding a dark secret that leads her to the unthinkable. Murder. End quote. And the trailer follows roughly that pattern, but that's not accurate at all. And here I'm going to arguably go into spoilers, but it's Catherine, it's Sarah Roy's character who has the dark secret. It's her issues, not her husband's issues, which sets off the whole chain of events, which culminates in this film. This is really not the film I signed up for, but fortunately, I actually really liked the film it turned out to be. So, even though the marketing is very, very misleading, which I think probably has something to do with the reason that there are a lot of very negative reviews of this film out there, fortunately, I liked the film it turned out to be. Right from the opening scene of this film, questions are raised. We see Sarah Roy in bed, and she is hearing whispers. She sees a giant spider in the corner of her bedroom, and spiders are a recurring motif throughout the course of this entire film. But she's hearing whispers. She's slightly disquieted, she's slightly panicking. Her husband is in bed next to her, and then he isn't in bed next to her. So what's going on? Is this a nightmare, or are there mental issues in play? So right from the opening scene, the mental state of our protagonist, Sarah Roy, is in question. Everything else we see in the film becomes debatable. And that adds in to the title of the film. I mean, Sarah Roy is white, and her friend who eventually shows up, Jade Anuka, is black. So the title of the film, Zebra Girl, in my mind, raises questions as well. And gradually throughout the course of the film, you realise what is going on, what the truth of the situation is. But it is done in such a gradual way. I mean, there is never a aha moment of revelation where it is revealed to the audience, this is what's happening. I mean, eventually at a certain point, the audience cottons on to what's going on. I mean, there is never a moment of exposition to say, this is happening because of this thing in her background. It never happens. There's never a moment of revelation. There's never a moment of exposition, which I really, really appreciate. I mean, it allows the plot of the film to gradually reveal itself. And some people will pick up what's going on very early, as I did, as, you know, the questions in my mind from that very, very opening scene were alert to possibilities. And the more things went on, I think, oh, right, that's what's going on here. But at a certain point, everybody will catch up and everybody will realise what the true plot of this film is, what the subject of this film actually is. It is not a woman snapping and killing her deceitful husband. It's much more complicated than that. It's a film about traumas in the past. It's a film about issues in the present of varying types. And ultimately, this turns out to be a tragedy. It's an uncomfortable tragedy. And the fact that on IMDb this is listed as a comedy is also way, way off the mark. I mean, yes, it does have occasional moments of jet black humour and ironic juxtaposition. I mean, like the use of pink in this very bleak, very disturbing film is really interesting. And I was already noticing the fact that there's kind of a pink filter over a lot of the cinematography towards the beginning of the film. And Sarah Roy's character is almost always wearing pink. I mean, even when we see her in flashbacks as a teenager, she's wearing pink pajamas. And in the present day, she's wearing a pink cardigan. A knife which she uses has a pink handle. And it's only when she specifically asks her friend Jade Anuka for a bow saw with a pink handle that you really appreciate the fact that, yeah, pink is a thing for this woman. And the way that she kills her husband, and gradually throughout the course of the film, through these flashbacks, through these conversations she's having with her friend Jade Anuka, we see what Sarah Roy's issues are, what her damage is, and see that, you know, things are not as they seem, both for us as an audience and for Sarah Roy as a protagonist. And gradually unpeeling that onion and seeing where things are going is really, really interesting. But calling it a comedy is just way off the mark. The brief moments of jet black comedy are completely drowned out by the disturbing and tragic elements of this story. I mean, ultimately, this is a tragedy. What this ends up most reminding me of, and this is probably going to be a big spoiler if you have seen the film I'm going to reference, but what this most reminded me of is the Marjane Satrapi film, The Voices, which ultimately has a very similar plot and is done in a very similar way. I really, really liked The Voices, starring Ryan Reynolds. That's an excellent film. And this has a lot of that in it as well. And there's also a tiny hint of Corey Finley's film Thoroughbreds as well, which I think is in the mix. So, yeah, those two films, which I really, really loved, are the touchstones that I found in this film. It's disturbing. It's arguably a horror film. It's a tragedy. But it's really, really well executed. I mean, the unraveling of this woman, the steps on the path to damnation, which is ultimately what this film boils down to, is really heartbreaking to see. I mean, decisions made for reasonably understandable reasons and issues that arise from genuine traumas in the past, and a lot of the time, the husband, Tom Cullen, being remarkably understanding, but being remarkably understanding sometimes just isn't enough. Particularly when you have a very tightly wound character like Sarah Roy. I mean, she has a very mild-mannered, sheltered attitude. She can't even say the word pornography. And yet she's perfectly happy to plunge a pink-handled knife into her husband's head and then chop him up with a pink-handled bow saw. I mean, there's the dichotomy present here, which is very disturbing to see. And yeah, overall, Zebra Girl, I think, works remarkably well. This is not at all the film I signed up for, but regardless of that, I did end up really enjoying the film it turned out to be. It's not going to be for everybody. It is tragic. It is disturbing. But I do think it's very, very good. Excellently performed by Sarah Roy. Very good direction from Stephanie Zari. And this is one of those films that if you think you can stomach it, I do think Zebra Girl, available through streaming platforms, is a yay, and I do think it's worth watching.
Netflix and chill.
The first Netflix film I want to talk about is the CG animated film from Russia, Secret Magic Control Agency. Netflix has started putting a lot of money into animation and animation from all around the world, and this one is largely produced by Russia and is one of those films that takes old fairy tales and puts them in a different context. This is a world like Shrek where all the fairy tales are living side by side, but because this is made in Russia, as well as the Western fairy tale canon of the Brothers Grimm, we also have some Slavic influences as well. But largely this is fairy tales which came out of the Bavarian forests and were written down by the Brothers Grimm. We start out with the king of this nation being kidnapped by food which suddenly comes to life. There's a bowl of spaghetti which lassoes him and flies him out of the window. Everybody is desperately searching for the king, but nobody can find him, and the best person to search for this kidnapped monarch is Gretel, who is one of the elite operatives of the Secret Magic Control Agency, but even she is stumped. So she has to team up with her estranged charlatan brother Hansel, who in a world of magic makes his money as an illusionist and con man. And reluctantly, Hansel and Gretel have to work together in order to find and rescue the king. Along the way, meeting people like Baba Yaga and the Little Mermaid and various other tropes of fairy tales. And I think the category that Secret Magic Control Agency best fits in is adequate. There's nothing spectacularly wrong with Secret Magic Control Agency, but there's nothing done particularly well either. It's amusing, it's diverting, it has one or two issues. I mean, some of the exposition is incredibly blunt. I mean, one of the motivations for Agent Gretel is she wants to become the best agent of the Secret Magic Control Agency. And at the end of the film, she's given a badge with best agent on it. I mean, what did an 8-year-old write this? Which he clearly didn't, because to make this plot work with all these fairy tales working side by side, there's a lot of convoluted things which need to happen. It's turning itself in knots to put in all the stuff we know from the traditional fairy tales and trying to make it fit together. And it's not always elegantly done. And also not particularly elegantly done is the animation. I mean, director Alexei Tsitsilin has put in some direct references and occasionally bizarre references to already existing animations. As I said, one of the villainous things that is used to kidnap the king is food which has been brought to life. And that includes a bunch of living cupcakes, which are firmly and directly based on the Minions. I mean, there's no two ways about it. These are Minions who just happen to be cupcakes as well. They look a bit like Minions. They certainly act and sound like Minions. They're Minions. There's also references to Disney films. I mean, at a certain point, you know, in this magical scenario, protagonists get turned into things. At one point, they get turned into a milk jug, which is very, very similar to Beauty and the Beast. At another point, they get turned into a fish, and bizarrely, this fish looks exactly like the fish from the very early DreamWorks animated film Shark Tale, the one that had Will Smith as a voice actor. I mean, the fish from Shark Tale, exactly the same design, is a very, very strange reference from a film in 2020. And along the way, they also meet a crab who is very, very similar to Sebastian from The Little Mermaid. So there's lots and lots of references to already existing animation, which ends up being really weird. But this does end up being a rather convoluted and somewhat complex story in order to shoehorn all this stuff in. And ultimately, by the end of the film, we have a plot contrivance which eventually leads to making a comment about spin and PR. What has just happened, we will turn into the fairy tale of Hansel and Gretel. With various different witches. I mean, there's at least two witches in this which fit into the Hansel and Gretel mythology, one of which is the Slavic character Baba Yaga. But by making this complex world and by spinning it in this way, I mean, I'm not sure it entirely lands. So, yeah, it's pleasant enough, it's diverting enough, it's entertaining enough, but I can't say that Secret Magic Control Agency is outstanding on any level. I mean, it's perfectly satisfactory. It's a completely dispassionate meh for Secret Magic Control Agency on Netflix. The other Netflix film I found the time to watch over the last week or so is the Malaysian horror film Raw, which was submitted by Malaysia to the International Feature Competition this year. I think Malaysia is one of those countries which has such a small cinema industry that any film which has a little bit of competence behind it gets submitted, even though horror films never get submitted to the Oscars. Although actually it worked for Guatemala this year with La Llorona, but that was a bit of a special case. But anyway, Soul, as it's also been released, is a film which is set in the past in the Malaysian jungle. A mother and her two children, a girl of about 13 or 14 and a boy of about 10 or 11, are eking out an existence in the middle of the Malaysian jungle. One day when the kids are out charcoal burning, a little girl follows them home. And, you know, the mother is concerned, you know, are you lost? Where are you? I mean, stay the night. We'll take you to the village across the river in the morning. But when the morning comes, the little girl makes a startling statement. By the time of the next full moon, you will be dead. Mildly freaked out by this, this little family in the middle of the Malaysian jungle also gets visited by two other people. A local wise woman slash witch slash shaman who lives on the hill across the river comes in and makes portentous statements about their future as well. And they also get visited by a half-blind huntsman who is in single-minded pursuit of his goal. So can this little family in the Malaysian jungle survive these mysterious and ominous visitors? And this, I think, is also a film, actually bizarrely similarly to Secret Magic Control Agency, which deals a lot in folktales, deals a lot in mythology and cautionary tales. I mean, there is a specific tale which this mother tells her children. Be wary of the men in the forest. They might be supernatural entities. There is something evil around it. I mean, multiple people at multiple different times throughout the course of this film says this area has something evil in it. And there's also a character which whispers in the ear of the young boy in this film, you shouldn't trust anybody. And that is honestly advice he should have taken to heart. I mean, basically what we have here is a lot of creepy, ominous, supernatural folk horror. The tales come to life. There is something dangerous in the forest, or in this case, the jungle. This is the Malaysian jungle rather than the Bavarian forest, but the ideas remain the same. I mean, you need to be protected. You need to be wary of the things which are out there in the darkness, in the wider world. You need to protect yourself. You need to protect others from the threat. But what is the threat is ultimately the thing. I mean, here we have a situation where in a lot of films, any of these three people who approach this hut might be dangerous, might be a threat. I mean, the creepy little girl, the quote-unquote witch who lives across the river, and the single-mindedly focused half-blind huntsman. All three of these characters are archetypes which could end up being the antagonist of this kind of film. And it really just boils down to which, if any, of these three entities, these three archetypes, are the actual threat of this film, and which are red herrings. And that is a question which is answered in interesting ways. I mean, everybody is under question. Everybody has these ideas. I mean, what is true? What is the best thing to do? How can I survive? How can I tell what is right and what is wrong? What is supernatural? What is natural? What is going to keep me alive and what is ultimately going to kill me? It's an interesting question, and it's kind of an interesting film. I mean, this is a creepy, supernatural, folk horror kind of tale with one or two jump scares which are well executed. And I do think that director Amir Eswan has created some rather interesting ideas. I mean, there's certain shots which I really, really liked. I mean, using great depth of field, certain camera movements, you know, gradually revealing stuff in this jungle is really interesting. And seeding it wholeheartedly in this Malaysian jungle environment. I mean, the opening of this film is a verse from the Quran. I mean, how many times have we seen a horror film, an English language horror film, where the opening quote was from the Bible? In this case, the creepy opening quote is from the Quran, which, you know, really embeds you into this Malaysian milieu. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to like here. There's lots of creeping dread. There's lots of folk horror. Occasional jump scares, which are well executed. Some very interesting direction and framing of this film. So, yeah, it might be a little bit meandering. It might be a little bit slight. Plot, quote unquote, is not the strong suit of this film. But atmosphere and threat is, you know, who can be trusted? Can anybody be trusted? And it works pretty well. So, yeah, for an interesting, diverting, supernatural horror, if you don't mind reading subtitles, then Ro, or Ra, on Netflix from Malaysia is a solid meh.
Coming attractions.
So the two big cinematic releases for this week are the similarly titled but very, very different films, In the Heights and In the Earth. In the Heights is a big, gigantic, glossy musical which was supposed to come out last year, directed by John Chu, who did the Step Up movies, or some of the Step Up movies, and Crazy Rich Asians, and written by, and songs by, Lin-Manuel Miranda. So I am intrigued about that film, even though musicals are not necessarily my thing, but this tale of the ethnically diverse working class area of Washington Heights and how the possibility of a large swathe of money might change people's lives sounds like it might be a lot of exuberant fun. So I do want to check out In the Heights. And at the other end of the spectrum is In the Earth, a horror movie by Ben Wheatley. This is one of those films that was conceived of and shot and produced and everything during the pandemic. A very small-scale film in which a scientist, Joel Fry, and a park ranger or guide, Elora Torkia, go into the forest in order to find answers to unknown scientific questions and come across crazy person in the woods, Rhys Shearsmith, and possibly some supernatural shenanigans as well. Apparently Hayley Squires is in this movie as well, which is always good to see. So, yeah, I'm intrigued to see what Ben Wheatley came up with during lockdown in this very small-scale, low-key way. Albeit that this possibly might have some connection or some similar values to another Ben Wheatley movie starring Rhys Shearsmith, A Field in England, which I have to admit I didn't like particularly much. So I'm certainly intrigued, but there's a decent possibility that I won't like In the Earth. But I do want to watch it, so that's on the list as well. When I was doing the preparation for this recording last night, making a list of all the things I needed to talk about, all the things that were in this show, all the things I needed to talk about for future shows, I noticed on the schedule for this weekend what is technically a preview of a film which is going to be released on June the 25th, but it's getting previews this weekend, as often happens with kid-friendly animated films. But this particular kid-friendly animated film really made my ears prick up. They've made a CG feature film version of Dogtanyan and the Three Musker Hounds. I had no idea this was happening. I did not know of the existence of this until I saw it listed at the cinemas this weekend. I loved the animated show when I was a kid. It's one of those European Japanese co-productions like Willy Fogg or Ulysses 31 or Lost Cities of Gold. I mean, all those Japanese-made, European-produced cartoons. But this one I did like. I mean, obviously based on the Alexandre Dumas story, The Three Musketeers, but making everybody dogs. And I used to really love it. So, yeah, I'm going to watch it, damn it. I mean, it's probably going to be incredibly fucking creepy that I'm the only unaccompanied adult watching this film, but I am fascinated by it, and I do want the nostalgia kick of watching D'Artagnan and the Three Muskerhounds. And when I discovered this late last night, that they'd made a movie of D'Artagnan, I tweeted it out. I basically said, W2F, they've made a D'Artagnan movie, with lots of exclamation points and question marks. And this morning I discovered that the director of the film had liked and retweeted that. Which is odd. I mean, I'm probably not going to like his film very much, but yeah, the director of this animated D'Artagnan film retweeted me, which was interesting. But yes, I do want to check out D'Artagnan and the Three Muskerhounds. I mean, whether that will be at these previews this weekend or whether I'll wait until it's officially released next week, I'm not sure. But either way, that's on the list. I still have a couple of films stored up on my tablet from that sale, which was on the recent bank holiday. We still got the Hungarian film Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time, and also the mind-bending sci-fi American indie Flashback. I also added to my tablet a rental of the horror film The Stylist, which I've been curious about for a while, particularly because of the involvement of Bria Grant, who is rapidly becoming one of my favourite women of horror. But I noticed that that was on very cheap sale on the Google Play Store, so I've added The Stylist to the list as well. And I have acquired through extra legal means the American indie comedy Shiva Baby, which has been released on Mubi this week, but Mubi just isn't a business model which jibes with the way I watch movies, so I'm not going to subscribe to Mubi, so I'm going to have to unfortunately pirate it, because I do really, really want to watch the film Shiva Baby, so I've got that and I will watch that at some point soon. Coming this weekend onto Sky Cinema is a film called The Comeback Trail, which sounds like a morbid variation on The Producers, in which a film producer played by Robert De Niro is in deep to a gangster played by Morgan Freeman. And it's weird that Robert De Niro's not playing the gangster in this movie, but anyway. Robert De Niro and his colleague Zach Braff realise that the only way that they can pay back the money they owe this mobster Morgan Freeman is to put on a film with an ageing action star played by Tommy Lee Jones, who notoriously does his own stunts. But if they work it out that Tommy Lee Jones dies on set, then the insurance from Tommy Lee Jones' death will be enough to pay off the gangster Morgan Freeman. So basically they're making this film in order for it to fail and in order to pay off their debts, which is a twisted, morbid version of The Producers, basically. So yeah, that looks like it might be interesting. That's on Sky Cinema this coming weekend. And I still have a lot of streaming films I want to get to. The Anarchic Teen Romance Dinner in America, the American Indie, about a Native American girl finding her mother once upon a river. Anthony Hopkins starring in his wife's latest film, Elise. The Canadian chamber piece, Stealing School, which I think I'm going to wait to come on Sky Cinema. And the Georgian Oscar submission for this year, Beginning, I'm still curious about. As well as the Czech film, Servants, which at this point is still only available at a premium rental price. I'm going to wait for that to become cheaper. Also released on streaming this coming week is a curious little film, which does sound rather interesting. It has the unusual title of Dr. Bird's Advice for Sad People, in which a teenage boy, played by Lucas Jade Zuman from 21st Century Women, is a very anxious and, possibly judging by the trailer, slightly mentally ill young man who is trying to cope with the disappearance of his sister and the tense marriage with his parents, Jason Isaacs and Lisa Adelstein, and also trying to connect to an attractive girl in his class, played by Taylor Russell from Waves and other things. And all the while, advice is being given to him by a pigeon who talks to him, voiced by Tom Wilkinson. So, yeah, I mean, whether that's about a quirky kid or a mentally ill kid, either way, it looks kind of interesting. So I do want to check out Dr. Bird's Advice for Sad Poets. Released this weekend on Amazon Prime Video is a film called Our Friend, which I saw listed fairly low down on the Gold Derby lists of Oscar potential. And it doesn't really look like my kind of film, but I might check it out. Our Friend is based on a memoir of a real-life person. I think he's a journalist. Played in the film by Casey Affleck, whose wife, Dakota Johnson, gets a terminal cancer diagnosis. So their best friend, played by Jason Segel, moves into the house and supports them and helps them through this trying time. Sounds like a bit of a weepy, but yeah, I'm probably going to check that out at some point, even though it's really not my kind of thing, that kind of emotional weepy kind of thing. But Our Friend has got decent people behind it and decent people in it, so I'm curious about Our Friend. Possibly the really, really big release this week is one that's coming out on Disney Plus, and that is the brand new Pixar movie, Luca. This is a film with a very odd premise of undersea creatures who look like the creature from the Black Lagoon a little bit. So, you know, that kind of, or The Shape of Water actually is a more modern reference, but that kind of gill man kind of thing, who live under the sea off the coast of Italy. And two of the younger people in this community go above the sea onto dry land and meet up with a spunky young girl who doesn't conform to normal stereotypes, and they go off on adventures together, all the while these two gill men, or gill boys, I suppose, trying to hide the fact that they are undersea creatures. So, yeah, that sounds really, really strange. I mean, a rather convoluted setup. I mean, an unexpected setup for a Pixar movie, but that's what they've chosen to do. And it is out this week on Disney Plus, so I will be checking that out through extra legal means. And also, possibly coming out this week, I mean, I've seen it listed, but I can't find any actual evidence that it is actually coming out, is an Irish horror comedy called The Boys from County Hell. It's entirely possible that this is only going to be available through Shudder. So, again, similarly to Lucky, I'm going to be pirating that, but whether or not it's on Shudder, I do want to check out this Irish horror comedy Boys from County Hell, in which a rough and tumble group of road workers accidentally reawaken an ancient Irish vampire and then have to survive the night in the middle of rural Ireland. So that sounds like it could be a lot of fun, and I do want to check out The Boys from County Hell. On Netflix, I still have to check out the big budget sci-fi film Awake, the Black Lives Matter movie Monster, the Mexican LGBT historical drama Dance of the 41, the Chinese animated film Wish Dragon, the Indian feminist parable Skater Girl, the Canadian low-budget animated film Dog Gone Trouble, the documentary Hating Peter Tatchell. I am morbidly fascinated by the Lifetime movie, Believe Me, The Abduction of Lisa McVeigh. I'm also curious about the Filipino film The Girl and the Gun, and the Mexican historical feminist film Tragic Jungle. The big film which is coming out on Netflix this coming week is a drama, again, possibly a weepy drama, starring Kevin Hart, who seems to be wanting more serious roles nowadays. This is a film called Fatherhood, which is based on a memoir of a young black man whose wife dies in childbirth, and suddenly he has to raise his daughter alone. And hijinks ensue and emotions ensue, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, again, could be kind of weepy, could be kind of emotional, but I'm curious to see what Kevin Hart does with a relatively serious role. So I do want to check out Fatherhood. I'm also curious about an Indonesian film which has found its way onto Netflix called Ali and Ratu Ratu Queens, in which an Indonesian boy, after the death of his father, travels to Queens, New York, in order to find his long-estranged mother, who moved to the States to search for work and basically was never heard of again. So this teenage Indonesian boy has to move to Queens, New York, in order to find his mother, and embeds himself in the Indonesian community they're in, and tries to find a place to belong and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that does sound kind of interesting, kind of cool. And I'm also curious about another Filipino film which has ended up on Netflix called Fangirl, about a young woman who is so obsessed with a particular heartthrob idol of Filipino cinema, she ends up hiding herself in the boot of his car, and of course the reality of this guy's life is totally different from the image she has built up in her mind. He's a nasty piece of work. And apparently, this heartthrob idol is being played by a genuine Filipino heartthrob idol playing a version of himself, which is an interesting prospect. But yeah, that does sound like an interesting premise, so I'm kind of curious about the Filipino film Fangirl as well. So, as ever, that is a very, very long list of films that are on my list of things to watch. And actually, this turned out to be a really, really good episode with lots of recommendations for you. The cinematic entries Ellie and Abby and Ellie's Dead Aunt and The Father are both thoroughly and highly recommended for very different reasons. And I do recommend the streaming film Zebra Girl as well. But be aware that is an uncompromising and tragic film ultimately. So it's an emotional roller coaster, but I think it's very well executed. So approach with caution, but I do strongly recommend Zebra Girl as well. And I think that's all I've got for you this episode. So, this has been Yay Nay Old Mare, presented by the Raw Footage Podcast. I've been your host, Con Gaisley from Bath in the southwest of England. Email is rawfootagepodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at rawfootagepod. And I'll see you next time, where I shine a light on cinema, both obvious and obscure.